My mom worked in restaurants, so I was used to that environment. That was pretty much all I knew. I was really sick as a kid. I was socially awkward. I wasn't comfortable in social settings, but I grew up in restaurants and I was literally like raised in a non-smoking section. And, you know, it was a neighborhood like casual restaurant. So if a busser called out or if they needed a bathroom mopped, my mom was the manager at that point, worked her way up from a host waiter to the manager of the restaurant. And she's like, well, that's what I have kids for. So like, here's $20, bus tables on your Saturday instead of going to the mall with friends, or mop the bathroom, you know, take a break from your math homework and run, clear these dishes off of table 14 because the table's done, and then finish your homework. That was all I knew. I didn't know or feel comfortable in like office settings or social settings. It was really, really hard and like kind of painful.
If you sit in a room or sit at a table with a lot of cooks, so many of those things are very similar. A lot of us choose the kitchen because other types of work is strange and awkward. Working in offices and traditional work environments was a bit exhausting. I'm extremely introverted as a kid. I was also very shy. I always loved food. I didn't know I had any other option. I fell in love with food work because I was like, oh, this feels right. It feels like home. Mm-hmm. It feels like I fit here. I don't have to have great social skills and no one's going to bother me if I'm quiet today. Cooking for someone is the easiest way to communicate with them. And I think that's another thing is, you know, we might not really talk about the way we work because it doesn't seem unusual to us to kind of be in a restaurant kitchen with no windows. We signed up for it. We're fine with it. We're a little bit crazy. Doing my research on you. And of course, I immediately latched on to Sunday's Best. It was like, I love a supper club. I love a dinner. Mm-hmm. I love a moment. A food moment for me is great. After you get into restaurants that you realize, or if you've been in restaurants your whole life, you realize it's a business first and food happens to be the product or service and not necessarily mm-hmm. the moment, because everything else has to be working in order for that to be the focus. Yeah. So when supper clubs got trendy again and people started doing things like out of their homes or, you know, their own kitchens and just like feeding their friends or neighbors or whatever, I really loved seeing that because it made food the moment again. And this conversation between eater and cook became central. Chefs, that's how we communicate most of the time. It's how we, you know, tell people who we are. So those moments bring everybody back into that space and help them get to know you. What I'm always curious about is what do these experiences give to you? It's very obvious what it gives to the eater, to the diner, to the person participating on the other side of the conversation. But what were you trying to communicate to people through that particular avenue?
So restaurants, and I've never owned my own restaurant. I've been exec chef of a restaurant. I've been exec sous of a restaurant. I've been sous chef. I've been line cook. I've been production. I've done all the roles in back of house. But I've never, in a restaurant setting, had the freedom. And it's an important distinction between a supper club and like a pop-up. So a supper club, you're right. Like most people host out of like an intimate environment, like their home or something like that. For the pop-ups that I've been doing, I've been hosting them out of restaurants. And that was important to me to be able to have that infrastructure, to be able to have staff already there. I don't have to hire people to come in. So, you know, doing the pop-ups were like a great way to hone menus, play with things, have freedom. It's not like I'm beholden to creating the same food night after night with a few changes here and there as I can fold them into service or menu changes. But it's, you know, it was just more like an outlet for expression. Like there's so much that I see in terms of Southern food, Black food, food ways that are shared among different cultures. And it's hard to be able to explain that to people. Like Chinese people were a huge immigrant group that came to the US South and built railroads across the country. And some people settled in different areas from the Florida Panhandle through Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas. Like, so they don't know certain things like yakimeng, which is like a Chinese beef broth soup that's in Louisiana. You know, they don't know how much grits and congee have in common. You know, they're just different things that like, you can't really, it's hard to explain. And sometimes I just, you know, I don't have the patience to explain it. I'm good with the written word, not spoken. I can never be that succinct or articulate clearly. So it's just so much easier. Like you said, it's a great way to communicate what I see in terms of cultural connections, because American cuisine, and that's what Sunday Best is all about. It's showing that American cuisine was built by Black people through agriculture, labor, and being in the kitchens. But it also incorporated techniques, ingredients, and influence from indigenous Americans from Mexico, Europeans that came over and settled, and, you know, so many others, like all the way through Vietnamese immigrants in the 70s. But before that, there was a huge influx of Irish, German, there were Italian, there were French immigrants that came. Some of them had money, some of them didn't. But they all fit into the social hierarchy of the United States, with Black people being at the bottom. So we kind of like took a little bit from everybody's culture and gave them a lot of our culture in the process. But there was this beautiful exchange, not always beautiful, don't get me wrong, but there was this exchange that happened culturally. And, you know, pre-refrigeration, everybody fermented, everybody pickled, preserved, did confit type things, like things like this that you associate with like French country cooking or Korean food. Our people did the exact same thing. My grandfather used to have a closet in his house in Chicago after he moved up from Mississippi, after he would till his garden every fall, whatever could be cooked was cooked. And then whatever they weren't going to use got pickled, preserved, fermented. He made shrubs, they call them now. Back then they just called them drinking vinegars. And there were all these things like in his, you know, larder, essentially, that, you know, when I first started getting introduced to other cultures, like through coworkers in restaurants, I'm like, oh, my God, that's so similar to what my grandfather did. Or that's so similar to this condiment I had in Mississippi visiting family. So the pop-ups were like the best way for me to explain the fact that I see how much we have in common.
Oh, that's good. We've all influenced each other, and we have American cuisine because of enslaved people.
Right.
I'm like, you can argue with the wall about that.
America because of enslaved people.
Well, okay. And I'm like, and in extension to that, you have a cuisine to speak of because of that.
Alice Waters and a lot of other chefs from the West Coast have even talked about for years that the only true American cuisine is Southern cuisine. And who was working the fields, who was working in the kitchens, who was working the land and in the houses? Black people.
I don't even talk about that anymore. Like you said, it's one of the easiest ways to communicate is just to cook the food. I love seeing certain cultures having a culinary moment right now, because it allows us to go, hey, so, you know, I know how everybody's into the kimchi right now. So let's talk about fermentation. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about where that exists in American cuisine, because you feel like it's something so far outside of you that you either won't touch it. You don't think you understand what's happening when someone talks about food from a different culture that you are from. And then when you realize that these are things you've been eating your entire life or that have been part of your own culture for a long time, you just didn't know.
Yeah. And sadly, a lot of times, like, we're very disconnected from that through poverty, through other, you know, other means of separation. Earlier in our history, a lot of people weren't able to pass on a lot of food ways. And then with the migration and people moving up north, you can replicate a lot of it, but you can't replicate everything. And sometimes whole families couldn't move. Sometimes it would be a couple family members, or the kids get sent to live with, you know, an aunt who's living in an apartment building. So that child is now disconnected from being able to see their parents gardening, see their parents preserving things. And then when that kid who moved up and is living in an apartment building has kids, they're even further disconnected from it. So if my grandfather hadn't had a house with a backyard on the south side of Chicago where he could plant a garden and tend to that every year, I wouldn't have seen this.
Oh, absolutely. One of my great aunts, that was her. Grew up outside of Philadelphia. And so, you know, she had a small garden, and, you know, you could go in her house at any time and you would see her with all her jarred goods from that. And then almost all houses in New Jersey have a basement of some kind. And so we could go down there and find more stuff. And so, like, when she passed, it was, you know, the one thing I kept asking people, I'm like, so what did y'all do with all of that food that was in her house? Oh, we just got rid of it. I'm like,
yeah,
I don't know what to say to you all. I mean, the woman grew those green beans herself and you threw them out. Okay. All right. It's fine. So making the leap into the cookbook then, is that the central theme to carry that intention from the restaurant experience or the pop-up experience and tell a broader story?
It's a little more subtle than that. It's more of just like the family story of my dad grew up in Mississippi. My mom is from the north side of Chicago and comes from a very different background. So she was and she worked in restaurants. So what we ate growing up was, you know, we'd have like Thai food one night, we'd have samosas another night, we'd have, you know, blackened catfish. The book is more using the restaurant experience of ways to make your food a little more special any day of the week, with giving it that Sunday love, but not having to give it that Sunday amount of cooking time.
Gotcha.
So the cookbook is more focused on their little subtle cultural things here and there. Don't get me wrong. Like, I throw it in wherever I can. Yakimane is in there. We talk about some of the story behind that. Talk about the Italian immigrants that came after slavery was banned and they were running three ships a month from southern Italy to bring workers over for the plantations. They were recruiting heavily from southern Italy. So all these people came over looking for work. Shortly thereafter, realizing plantation work sucks. And if you have the choice, nobody wants to do it. But you have all these Italian immigrants that were already here. Some of them sent for the rest of their families and set up shop essentially in Mississippi, southern Louisiana, some farther inland. But you had such a huge population that even just outside the French Quarter was called Little Palermo. So there's huge Italian influence on the cuisine of the South. So like Mississippi pot roast uses like pepperoncini and like dried Italian herbs. And people are like, why? It's similar because it's a red wine braised cut, but why, you know, the flavor's different. It's like, that's the Italian influence. So there are things like that sprinkled throughout the book, but overly it's more about loving up on your food any day of the week and thereby loving up on yourself every day of the week.
Oh yeah. If we can bring back some type of, the thing that excited me, and there wasn't much about the pandemic that excited me besides not having to interact with people and being able to stay in the house. I was hoping for introverts all over the world. We were like, for real?
I've been training for this.
We're good at this, guys. We're good at this. We'll get you through it. So between that and then just watching people like get in their kitchens again and realize that there was this room in their house where they could actually feed themselves from it.
Yeah.
And just being able to sit back and watch the social component of that, like what was happening on TikTok and what was happening on Instagram and like how people were helping each other learn how to cook. And it's like some things were absolutely cringeworthy and you just wanted everyone to stop talking about it because it's like, this is not the way you do this, guys. But at the same time, it's like you didn't want to discourage the curiosity and discovery, because it's like if we can get you back in the kitchen, and you might not necessarily fall in love with it hardcore the way some of us have, but the idea that cooking for yourself is self-care and cooking for yourself is a way to express love and to cherish yourself and other people, and just that it's an emotive activity. It's way past just kind of the tactical physical experience. There's an expression of yourself there. I think that's what exactly. I was just like, you know, people making bread for the first time and like sharing it with their neighbors, or, you know, just kind of even cutting into it themselves and going, oh my God, you can make bread at home. This is incredible. Like, I don't have to go to the store anymore. And you're just like, oh, look at you guys win. This is exciting. So I really loved when like cookbooks that people had purchased and they had never cracked open, and they were finally like, well, let me try a recipe. And then they got obsessed. You know, there were certain ones where it was like, oh, now they know what like a sourdough starter is. That was not a collective conversation we were having before that. You know, banana bread and those kind of things. And so all the while we're kind of creating these spaces of comfort for ourselves, you know, the people who were like not used to being home. I was also like, oh my gosh, this is a window for us food folks to like kind of re-engage the rest of the world about food and cooking and feeding yourself and how important that is. And it's just like, oh, we can now all kind of understand each other. Because a lot of times, you know, you feel outside of it. You order your food, it mysteriously shows up in a bag with utensils, or you go to a restaurant and all of a sudden it's magically on your table and you don't understand the process or the people behind it. And so we weren't having a collective conversation around any of it. And I think it's actually even improved our conversations around how instrumental the food industry is to climate change and climate stability. It's just not a conversation we're actively having just yet. It's like in all of the systems that absolutely have to drastically change for us to manage our climate goals, food is in the top three. And it's not a conversation we've been having because people were so disconnected from the process, like how their food is sourced. And even right now with inflation and realizing when you go to the grocery store, your grocery bill is 20% higher and people going, why is that? And then you understand how vital the food systems we build and sustain are to your life and not just what you put in your body, but how you spend your money and how we take care of our resources. And so the more like your cookbook and the more cookbooks that kind of that are offering people ways to have a deeper engagement with the process of cooking because you've created a level of like ease and simplicity around certain things. I think that's one of the bigger hills you have to climb when you're writing a cookbook is that, okay, how do I take this information and distill it in such a way where it's not so simple you don't learn anything, but it's not so complicated you're intimidated and all you do is kind of read the stories and drool over the recipes and the pictures. And that's all you do. It's like you want that sweet spot where people feel anything's possible. I can do this. And then when they get it, and then you have cooks who are a bit more ambitious, home cooks who are a bit more ambitious are like, oh, this seems really interesting or new, or this is a technique I haven't used in a while or haven't used before. And it feels just challenging enough for them and just approachable enough for those of us who aren't, those people who are not really adept in the kitchen. And so it's, you know, I would know, but I would love for you to kind of talk a little bit to the audience about your process of like creating that simplicity around those recipes and making those recipes approachable, considering like some of them might have ingredients they've never heard of or they don't know where they can get, or it might be a technique they've never, you know, used before in the kitchen. What's your, as a professional who's been in this space for so long, what's your process to kind of take that more complex stuff and just create a simpler space or dialogue about it?
It's pretty straightforward. Like every chef thinks they want to write like a very chefy book, something beautiful that sits on a coffee table. And I bought those books for years as a cook. I would always buy like the big glossy book that looks great, but has techniques that like we rarely even used in restaurants, but the book looked great. So it was nice to have. And it was kind of like a, you know, almost like a badge of honor to have it like in your home. So when your coworkers came over for drinks or something or hung out on a day off, they're like, oh, you have the such and such book and this and that. But I remember the one book that was probably the most useful out of all of them was the French Laundry Cookbook, because it talked about the importance of certain things and why certain things are done a way that they are. So it kind of, if you're a professional, you got one level of things from it. If you're a home cook, you got a whole nother level, but everybody was learning something. Line cooks could figure out why we don't cut corners on certain things, why you wait for the water to come up to a rapid boil before you drop your green vegetables, why it has to be heavily salted, why, you know, the why behind things that let you know not to cut this corner because essentially your chef is going to send your mise en place back and have you redo it. So the French Laundry Cookbook was really cool and really eye-opening for me as a chef, but also like somebody who's learning food, you know, as like a young cook and learning why things are done a certain way in fine dining when I hadn't seen them done that way in other restaurants I worked at. So I use that as a touchstone. And then I also have a sister who's married and has two kids, and she loves cookbooks because she likes to change up the repertoire and like find new things. And she would always tell me the books that she liked to use and the books that she didn't like to use and why. The books she didn't like to use always had like crazy ingredients that you have to like search to the end of the earth. She's like, I got two kids. I don't have time to drive around or call five grocery stores to see who has XYZ. Like, it's too much. And then also books that say, you know, refer to page 82, but you're on page 243. And she's like, now I have to flip back and find this other component recipe that needed to have been done before. And, you know, so I kind of looked at this book. If I'm lucky enough or fortunate enough to get another cookbook deal or like do another book, you know, then I'll revisit that. But I wanted this book to be something that's like splattered in grease. It's approachable, but everybody will learn something, no matter what level of cook or chef you are. You can find something, like you said, that's challenging enough to make it fun and make it engaging, but you can also find stuff that's like easy and accessible to do. And like one thing I talk about in the book is like, buy a rotisserie chicken at the grocery store if you don't have time. And then, you know, a lot of cookbook recipes have a complete dish where it's a protein, veg, and starch all in one long recipe. I split all of those up. So in the chapter, the proteins are all together, the veggie sides are all together, and then the starches are all together. So that way, if you pick up a rotisserie chicken, sprinkle some, you know, some seasoning on it and pop it under the broiler, but then make this side dish or make your protein and then pick up a couple sides from like Whole Foods or whatever, you know, hot buffet you want. So it was more just kind of like making sure that everybody can learn something, because I'm learning stuff all the time. I learn something new about food every day, and it's so exciting. And one thing that like my sister loved was when I would give her like little tips about things that we do in restaurants that make it just slightly different. So in one recipe, I'll have like a way to finesse it. If you have a few more minutes to do this step, cool, but it's not necessary. And then I'll have like a little extra credit here and there too. Like if you really want to step it up, you can add this or this component. But yeah, it was kind of like, here's a great recipe. I tested it, had other people who are home cooks test it, which is really important. You don't want to have chefs test it. You don't want just yourself to test it. And then I tested them again to see if there were steps that I could cut out and make sure that it's simple, but every step has high impact and means something and does something for the dish. And if it doesn't do something, like throw all that shit in the food processor. You don't have to cut everything by hand all the time. You know,
use all them tools you done bought from Pampered Chef for the last decade. Like, you didn't bought all the stuff, guys. You didn't got the garlic chopper and everything else. Just use it. Please don't. I think that is one of the major conversations to have. It's like, look, the way restaurants do things, there's the methodology behind it is usually dedicated to efficiency and not necessarily flavor outcomes. Like those were, you had different metrics in restaurants for success and efficiency than what you do at home. Chefs at home do not cook the way they do in the restaurant because no one's yelling. No, there's not a ticket machine going off creating PTSD for a lifetime. There's none of that. Have you ever seen a group of chefs in the restaurant and they hear that machine go off? Oh my God. The terror.
I'm sitting at a bar and I hear a ticket machine at the bar. I immediately tense up.
Like my ass just clenched because I heard someone's machine go off and I'm not okay. Yeah. Like it's a trauma response. Yeah. It's fine. But do not let your consumption of food media cause you to misunderstand exactly what's happening or what you're seeing. Consistency is a huge metric for restaurants. I'm like, if you went to a restaurant every week and every week everything tasted differently, you'd be very upset. And even if it tasted better, you would still be upset because it's not what you had last week that you had such a great time with. You want the same thing you had last time.
They want the same thing that they love so much and they come to you for. You have to produce it the exact same way every time.
Exact same way. Thoughtfulness in cookbooks, like your sister is saying, like, you know, giving someone those little tips and hints and stuff to just help them, you know, get to the place they want to be as a cook is always what I look for in a quality cookbook. When I'm kind of sitting in the bookstore, like who's writing things right now, who put things out and, you know, going through recipes, you're like, okay, so is your intention to help the person using your book to be better for themselves or to just kind of peacock a little bit about what you know, because
that's exactly what it is.
It's real obvious that you're just talking about the things you know how to do, because it's not practical to ask someone to do that. They don't know how to, no one is going to do whole hog barbecue in their one bedroom apartment in Manhattan. It's just, I'm going to always go out and buy that from somebody else who has the space and time to smoke a pig for 14 hours. Like, I'm not going to do that at my house. Just not going to do it. Same thing with rotisserie chicken. Unless I stayed up all night and watched the infomercial to buy the Ron Popeil rotisserie countertop rotisserie chicken situation.
And sacrifice counter space and storage space. Not happening.
I'm going to go to the grocery store, find the best rotisserie chicken I can.
Yeah.
And go with that. And then I'm going to use all the parts. I'm going to make maybe some chicken stock. I'm going to utilize the bird that I get, but I am not setting up a rotisserie in my house to make a chicken every now and again on a rotisserie. It's just not, no. And so, like, thoughtfulness and consideration in, like, cookbook writing and cookbook authorship for me is like the sign of a very generous chef and a very generous cook. I have like a personal mission to make sure that people use cookbooks in such a way that there's grease splattered on the pages and there's like tomato sauce on. I want people to use cookbooks. I want them to like.
I want pages folded and notes taken. Changes the like you don't have this, substitute this. Like, it's a guideline. Yes, if you follow the recipe, learn the technique, follow it a couple times, but then freestyle it once you like. Once it's become part of your muscle memory, part of your repertoire, freestyle it and have fun with it.
Oh my gosh. I was like, because I have people who buy cookbooks and they never look at them past like the bookstore. And I'm just like, why are you purchasing? Cookbooks are not cheap. Why did you spend $78 on this cookbook if you were not going to use it? I'm confused. Yeah. And usually I'll go to someone's house and I'll pull cookbooks off their shelves and they're just like, I forgot I bought that. I'm just like, your priorities are a mess. And I'll open them and I'm like, cook this. You have all the ingredients in your pantry. They'll get in the rut and they're just like, I don't know what else to cook and I'm bored and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, you have like 19 cookbooks. Like, just pull one of those off the shelf and, I'm just like, never mind. I've used your cookbooks, people. Please use your cookbooks. Like, chefs and cookbook authors do not write cookbooks for you to just glance at and treat them like magazines. We want you to use them. Yeah. Like, we've poured all of this energy and knowledge in general. I'm like, I think, and that's the other thing. It's like, if people knew, like, there's plenty of restaurants where the exec or the sous are not super generous. As a line cook, you really just fumble your way through each position and try to figure it out. And if you can find a chef that is willing to share what they know and, you know, their experiences, you always produce better cooks coming out of those kitchens. And it's so, like, cookbooks are, for me, the chefs that do them because they want to share that information. They're excited about it themselves and they want other people to know. When people don't cook from those, I'm just like, if you only knew that there's a shortage of chefs that are that generous and cooks that are that generous. So like, when your grandmother would bother to explain to you how she made her biscuits, you had the audacity. Just like those things, like just thinking about the cooks in your own family who are just not going to tell you. You have to kind of like watch over their shoulder and hope you pick up a few things. But these things are sacred to them. These techniques and recipes are like, they're not going to tell you. And so for me, I'm like, it's just, if you get someone who's prepared to tell you, hey, these are the things that have worked for me and these are the things I think are delicious. And like, I just, it's a love language. And I'm like, use the cookbook.
Use the cookbook.
I'm like, to that point, what recipes would you know, someone purchases the Sunday Best, like, where would you say, cook this recipe first?
Um, That's a tough question. So I guess it depends on, you know, where you want to start. I would start with like the green cabbage gratin. It teaches you like searing and then just put it in a pan, pour your cream mixture and stuff over it, sprinkle your cheese and breadcrumbs on top. So it's kind of like learning to braise. It's also learning to gratiné something. And it's, you know, it's, that is just fucking delicious. Like,
there you go. It's just, I was like, and for no other reason. It's right. Fucking delicious.
It's like, really damn good. I think like that would be one to start with for sure. And then if you're going for like a stew, something a little more hearty, try the chicken with cornbread dumplings. It's kind of like matzo ball soup, but with like chicken gravy, so a little thicker, with like cornbread matzo. Those would be two great ones to start with. And then like the beer and soy marinated roasted chicken, super simple. You just throw it in a bag together and then put it on a tray and roast it after it's marinated. You know, it's things like that, low input, but high output.
Those are all very impressive dishes. People will think you've done more than you did. And of course the flavor payoff again is like, what did you do to this? And how did you, and why? I used to manage the kitchen for a summer camp, and every now and again, like in between like campers being there, we would just kind of go nuts and try to clear the walk in a little bit. We had this huge grill, so I grilled some flat iron steaks. We had these really beautiful scallions that were in abundance one summer, and so I ended up taking those and just giving them a really quick marinade, and just so happened to just like, you know what, I don't want to like do anything. I just threw them on the grill. We had some residual heat. I just threw them on the grill and let them kind of cook off. And I didn't break, I took the root end off, but that was it. But I left them whole. So it was like the bulb and the stem and everything else. And so I was like, I'll just throw them all on there at the end. And like, I sliced the steak and just left that on a cutting board, grabbed the scallions off and just kind of heaped them onto one big platter and finished it with a little olive oil and like a touch of red wine vinegar while it was still hot. Super simple. I mean, it was ridiculously simple, but they cleared that platter of those scallions so quickly because someone was like, so that's how you eat them? And I'm like, yeah, they're tender. Like, it's just go in and eat them, guys. It's fine. Salt, pepper, vinegar, and oil. It did not, they were waiting for this big show and production. And I'm just like, the scallions themselves are the production.
Yeah.
What more do you want from this plant? Like, the plant gave you all it's going to give you. Just eat it. And so one kid got into it. They grabbed one. They're like, well, I'll try it. As soon as he got into it, he was just like, oh my God, I've never tasted anything like this. And I'm just like, so everyone at that point was curious and was like, I didn't realize you could do this to food. I'm like, do what? The food did it itself. It was the sun.
That is so cool.
A little photosynthesis and you're good to go, guys. It's really, the food did the work. I really want people to use their cookbooks.
Yeah. It's fun to talk about that. Like in the book, I talk about steps that you can do this up until this step. Yeah. And then put it on the tray when your guests come over, pop that tray in the oven to either finish cooking or warm up. But that's important because people need to know that in restaurants, we're not doing everything a la menu. We're not executing everything from step one to step 10 when it's ordered. A lot of things are done ahead and it doesn't sacrifice quality. So that's definitely something that like I put in the book to try to get people comfortable with like, have this done and this done. Have your steak seared off. And then, you know, 20 minutes before you want to eat, pop it in the oven at 500 for, you know, 7 to 10 minutes, however long you want to cook. And then let it rest and slice. You know, but you don't have to be tied to the kitchen all the time. Take 20 minutes and knock out one part of prep and then come back and finish it up.
That's invaluable information for anybody who aspires to cook in any capacity, is that there's an order to like not letting it bury you. And, you know, I'm like, if you would be surprised how much prep goes. I'm like, you know, once you get to dinner service, it's really about assembly. You are still trying to prep an onion by the time that first ticket comes through, usually you just get sent home. They're like, you know, just go home. You don't understand what we're doing here. So just go home. It's not for you today. But like, that was something else to demystify when we would talk about prep and like me's. It was like, oh, I'm like, yeah, you guys, don't think that we're coming into the restaurant 10 minutes before 5 or 6 going, okay, the doors are open. The first person's seated and here we go. We're going to start prepping now. Like, no, trust me. That would make you very angry as a diner to have to wait for us to prep what you're going to eat. Most of it is assembly and just literally applying heat at that point. It sounds like you have another cookbook in you. And because it sounds, you know, I'm of the same mind, like there's always something to learn. So what is it right now for you that you're curious about, that you're asking questions about, that you're trying to make some discoveries about? And do those tie into kind of like the cookbook you feel that's still kind of sitting in your head or in your heart to put out?
There's a book that I've wanted to write for a while. But it's definitely like a longer format research project. And I did, you know, for this one, I wanted to get something on the shelves to kind of introduce people to me, get people cooking. So this was something that was more a short term, like by short term, I mean 2-year project. But there is a book that like, I would love to write a little bit more about, you know, how like in culinary school, they give you like culinaria and it takes a country and it goes region by region. I would love to do that for the South. I would love to do that for not just the South, you know, for the U.S. in general, but, you know, Southern cooking gets this bad rap as being heavy and being, you know, too humble. I would love to show how hyper-regional it is. You know, there's corn culture versus rice culture, depending on where in a state you are. I'd love to show, you know, and a lot of that is kind of dictated by the indigenous tribe that was there when slaves came in and some of the things that they taught them and they learned starting off. So I'd love to do a regional cookbook focusing on east of the Mississippi and kind of just show the hyper-regionality of U.S. cooking by the indigenous culture that was there already, where in Africa the enslaved people were from, what cooking techniques they brought with them, what ingredients they brought with them. That would be like my dream project.
Ooh.
I did a residency. I was chef in residence at Blue Hill Stone Barns last summer. And during that research for that experience, it was like, you know, a 6-month planning project because we got to plant the crops, decide on the menu, plant ahead, get everything in the ground. So I did so much research. And, you know, with industrialization, it kind of, America was such a young country that by the time industrialization came around, it kind of got rid of a lot of the regional specialties. But there are still vestiges of that. And, you know, I started doing a lot of research on that last year to get ready for the residency program. So I would love to like really dive deeper into that and travel around the country and kind of talk to people that are still living and get their memories and get their food ways that they grew up on to kind of help piece all that together.
Well, how can people find you? Where can, of course, the cookbook's available currently to purchase just about everywhere, I would say. Yeah, I think I've seen it everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, there's an indie bookstore in your neighborhood, hopefully they're carrying. If not, ask them to carry it. You can find the cookbook, you know, obviously you can Google it or you can go straight to Barnes & Noble, Amazon. You can look up the publisher, Clarkson Potter or Penguin Random House to find it there. So there's definite ways you can find it. I have the link for it in my bio on Instagram, which is Chef Adrian Cheatham. I just keep it simple. I mean, it's, you know, social media is always a great way to start. It's also being carried at some smaller like grocery stores around New York.
Nice.
So check them out.